Do you want more energy, better sleep, and better health? Who wouldn't? Get a free Scalar Light no obligation 15-day trial at scalarlight.com.
Would you know how to get rid of your fear, phobia, stress, or anxiety? How to burst your fear and transform your life? Welcome to Fear Busters Show, presented by Lauren Rosenberg, fear and phobia relief expert and author of How to Move Forward When the Unthinkable Happens. You are listening to UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio with Lauren Rosenberg. www.fear-busters.com.
Hi, so we are very lucky today. We have Ari Sean Brown today as a guest. And Ari, could you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Ari Sean Brown. I live in the States, married, beautiful wife, five beautiful children and a bunch of grandchildren. I am a motivational speaker. I am a coach. I have a 8-week mentoring group mentoring program. We can talk about that later.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm happy to be on your show.
Thank you very much. So, Ari, the reason why I invited you to for the show is that you've unfortunately experienced an unexpected event that probably change your life, and we're talking about fear, and I would like you if you could share your story with us and how you cope, what you find it was useful, and how did you manage to get. So do you want to explain and tell us your story?
Sure. So I'm a 9/11 survivor. I was working in the World Trade Center. I was on the 78th floor of Tower 1 when the first plane hit. I was actually running late that morning. My son had a book order that he had to do for school. It was 1 week before the high holidays. My wife, who is a school principal, was very, very busy. Besides getting ready for the holidays, she was also very busy in the house with she was very busy in school, opening school, etc. She didn't have the patience for my son, so she wanted me to do the book order with him. It was about 20 to 7 in the morning that morning, and I had my briefcase over my shoulder, my cup of coffee in my hands, and I yelled up to my wife, bye, honey, love you, see ya. I yelled up to my kids, bye, kids, have a great day in school, and I started to walk out the door.
Like an old day. Mm-hmm.
Like a normal day, yes. Mm-hmm. And my wife yells out to me, she says to me, did you do Baruch's book order? Baruch is my third child. He was 8 years old at the time. And I said, no, I didn't do it. And she says, you're not leaving the house until you do it. So I went into my house, put down my briefcase, put down my cup of coffee, walked into my kitchen, proceeded to negotiate with my 8-year-old for the next 20 minutes. I whittled him down to two books. And at this point in time, I was running about 20 minutes late, and I was, like, really, really upset. I picked up my briefcase, picked up my cup of coffee, left the house, was really, really ticked at my wife the entire time while I was going. Didn't get to the Trade Center until 20 minutes to 9.
Usually, what time would you would have been there earlier?
Normally I would have been in my office at 8 o'clock.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But so. It was now 20 to 9, so the 20 minutes actually cost me 40 minutes. So I was waiting for an elevator to come down, and there was about – my office was on the 101st floor, but you couldn't take an elevator all the way up to 101. You can take an elevator up to 78, which was an express. And then on the 78th floor, which was a sky lobby, you would have to change to get to another elevator to get to the higher floors. The first elevator that came down was all the way on the right side of the lobby, so I went running down to the end of the lobby. There were about 11 or 12 of these huge elevators. They had like – They were able to hold like 50 people, and they were the fastest elevators in the United States. There was actually one in the middle, smack in the middle, that went express all the way from the lobby up to the 106th floor, which was the restaurant windows on the World.
Yes, and you didn't have a fear of height then.
it did it in like under a minute. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
your ears used to pop when you took this elevator.
I mean, I was going to say, yes. I mean, the pressure to go up.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Yeah. So the elevator came down. It was all the way on the right side of the lobby. So I ran down to the end of the lobby and got into the elevator. It led us off on the 78th floor, which is, as I said, the Sky Lobby. And now the bank of elevators that I needed to get to my office on the 101st floor was all the way on the left side of the Sky Lobby. So I walked out of the elevator and I hung a left and I started to walk towards that bank of elevators. I must have been about 8 feet from those bank of elevators when, as best as I can describe, there was an explosion. The entire building shook. The lights went out. The place filled with smoke and I was literally thrown off my feet. And there was yelling and screaming. Someone was yelling about fire in the elevator. And I figured, of course, there's fire in the elevator. I thought a bomb had gone off in the elevator. That was the feeling that I had. And I was scared. I was really, really scared. I'm looking around. I don't know what to do or where to go. But all of a sudden, I see a light in between two banks of elevators. And it must have been an emergency light because all the other lights went out. So I figured that's probably a safe place to go. But there was a lot of smoke. And, you know, I learned as a kid when there's smoke, you stay low to the ground. I literally crawled from where I was to that light. And then I got up and I went around the bank of elevators and I found a door there. And I opened the door. And sure enough, there was an office, a security office. And in that office was this woman security guard who was sitting on the floor. And she was crying her eyes out. And I leaned over to her and I said to her, "Ma'am, calm down. We're going to be okay. We're going to get out of here." I walked back out into the hall, and I bumped into a coworker of mine. Her name was Virginia DiChiara. Now, Virginia was on the elevator that I was about to get on when the plane hit, and she described the scene to me. The elevator doors had started to close, and they jammed about a foot. They were open for about a foot when the plane hit. And the walls of the elevator collapsed. The ceiling collapsed. There was a cable in the elevator that had snapped. It was sparking. The jet fuel came down the sides of the elevator, ignited by the sparks, and there was a wall of fire. There were three people in the elevator. There was Roy Bell, Virginia, and Renee. Roy Bell was the first one to jump through the fire, and he suffered second-degree burns. Virginia jumped through next. She suffered third-degree burns. Mm. And Renee died from her burns, all in a space of 6, 8, 10 seconds. That was the difference between life and death that day, at least for these three people. Virginia sees me, she says to me, "Ari, please help me. Whatever you do, please don't leave me." I said to Virginia, "I promise I will help you. I won't leave you, and we will get out of here." Now, I gotta pause for a minute because Virginia and I, we weren't good friends. Mm-hmm. She was an internal auditor who had been hired by Cantor Fitzgerald the year before. And the first department she audited was mine, and she almost got me fired. Needless to say, we were not good friends. But, you know, I was in a position now where here was another human being who was in trouble, and I happened to be the guy that was there. And I said to her, I did what I felt, you know, I did the right thing, basically. And I said, "Virginia, I will help you, and we will get out of here." We ultimately walked down 78 flights of stairs together. And I got her out into when we got down to the street level. The cops let us know that there was they were setting up a triage center across the street, and they told me to take her over there and get her into an ambulance. And we went across the street, and sure enough, an ambulance pulls up, and I got her into the ambulance. And it took a while, but originally I said, you know, so, you know, they weren't leaving. They were working on her in the ambulance, but they weren't leaving. And I asked the ambulance driver, I said, "Why aren't you leaving?" He goes, "We're expecting a huge amount of casualties, and we can't leave until we fill the ambulance." In the meantime, Virginia was writhing in pain. She was telling me, "Ari, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it." I said, "Virginia, hold on. You're going to be okay." Finally, they had like 6 or 7 people in the ambulance. They said, "Okay, we're ready to roll." Virginia turns to me, and says to me, "Ari, you're coming with us." Now, I don't want to say I was in a comfort zone because of what was going on, but the reality is I knew where I was. And if I needed to get someplace else, I would know how to get there from where I was. And the thought of getting into an ambulance and going who knows where didn't excite me. besides, once she's gone, there's only one place I'm going, and that's back into the building, because I'm looking for coworkers. I'm looking to help. I'm looking to do something. Virginia, I said to Virginia, you don't need me anymore. I'm going to get a hold of your mom. She's going to, you know, she'll meet you at the hospital. You're going to be okay. She literally turned to the ambulance driver. She says, we're not leaving unless he comes with us. I looked at him. He looked at me. He says, you know what? Fine. Hop into the front. And I got into the front of that ambulance and we pulled away. We were only one of a few ambulances that actually got away from the scene that day. I saw pictures of crushed ambulances, crushed fire trucks at the scene. At the end of the day, I always said, who saved whose life?
Yeah,
she thanks me. She thanks me every day for saving her life. And I say to her, you got it all wrong.
You saved your life.
If she wouldn't have insisted I get into that ambulance, I would have been standing at the base of that building when it came down. I'd be dead. Sure as I'm standing here today. But she insisted. And that's why I'm around today to tell you my story. There's a lot more to it, obviously, because it was a long day.
Yeah.
But there isn't time for much more. But that was basically the crux of why I'm still here today.
So how did you manage afterwards to manage to do day-to-day life? And how did you get back to sort of what we can say normal? Because obviously that had a big impact on everyone. Even I remember that when it happened, I turned the TV on, and just by watching it, we couldn't believe what was happening. So how had you, as any fear, I mean, how do you sleep at night? How do you deal with all the images that you had in your mind?
So I will tell you, I was living on Ambien for about a month. All right. I couldn't sleep. Mm-hmm. All right. The dreams were just, you know, it was over and over again. I became a little paranoid. When I would leave my house in the morning before I walked out, I would open my door slightly. I'd look up and down the street to see if anybody was coming, if there was any suspicious people around. All right. I was paranoid. I went to the doctor who gave me some medication. And the thing that helped me through it all more than anything was my family. Mm-hmm. I had four children at the time. My oldest was 15. My two girls were 15 and 13. My boys were 8 and 6. And they were just a pillar of strength for me. As a matter of fact, it was at the end of October, there was the company, Cantor Fitzgerald, that was the company I worked for. They had a memorial for the fallen. We occupied the top 5 floors of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. And we lost 658 people out of 960 that were employed there.
Wow.
And the reason it was 658 is because that's the number of people that were above the plane when the plane hit.
Mm-hmm.
All the other employees, either they weren't there or they were below the plane. I mean, there were four of us that were on the 78th floor. So it was below the plane. The plane hit 92 or 93. All right. But, you know, the impact, obviously, that we felt and that caused the injuries was immense. So it was difficult. I remember the next day, my wife went to work. My kids went to school and I was home alone. And there was nothing else for me to do other than watch TV. And all I kept seeing was the towers falling over and over and over again.
That's true. People didn't think of that because obviously it was the news and you could see it all over and again and again. And nobody ever thought actually, like you, have gone through it and survived. And then you turn the TV on and you see all those reports. So that must have, it's like reliving it again. And
absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, even to this day, you know, I do a lot of motivational speaking.
Yes.
I talk about my experience. I talk about, you know, why I was saved or the reasons that in my mind why I was saved.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I show a short video before I start speaking about the events of the day. And every time I show the video, I get all choked up. You know, it just brings back the memories. It's 19 years later. And for me, it's like it was yesterday.
Because it's the subconscious mind lives in a present time. So it's unless you actually delete the images, you'll be seeing it right in front of you. And like you said, it's like living it. It's because you were there. I presume even like the noise, or you, did you find you became more sensitive to noise or much more on high alert or
anything? Oh, for sure. You know, loud noises, even to this day, loud noises scare me. You know, mm-hmm. I hear unexpected noises scare me. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, it never happened before. And I'm, again, I attribute it to, you know, what I went through there. But, you know, it's just, you know, there are certain things that, you know, I'm much more sensitive today. I get scared much easier today. You know, I don't want to say that I'm not afraid to walk down the street. I'm not afraid to, by the way, I'm not afraid to go into a high building either. Although yeah. I was yeah, for I'm a sure. while where I wouldn't go up to a high floor. But I'm not
going into lift. Would that be, you're okay going into lift?
Yeah. I'm not afraid about going into a lift, elevators mm-hmm. for those in the States.
Yeah.
No, I'm not, that doesn't.
I had a client actually who, she was just, yeah, she wouldn't go into lifts or any escalators, and she would just, and that was creating problems, always having to use the stairs. But yeah, it's, so what's more like, what do you think? I mean, yes, it's understandable that loud noise, because I can't imagine even the noise and all what you must have heard while you were in there. Anything else that this happened.
I was going to tell you, because I started to tell you a story. Mm-hmm. We had our memorial at the end of October, and my wife said to me before I left the house, why don't you take the girls with you? And I said, why? And she said, just for support. And I go, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. And she said, no, take the girls. And I said, I don't need to take the girls. They're 15 and 13. I didn't need to take them into the city. You know, there was still also that fear, you know, mm-hmm. the fear factor of what can happen. I said, no, I'm going to be fine. And the two girls came to me and said to me, Dad, we really, really want to come with you. Please, please, we really want to come with you. I said, fine, no problem. So I took the girls with me. We went to the memorial, and these were the first people that did that. They went through, they mentioned all the names, and they had a video screen with pictures of all the people that were killed. And I lost it. I totally broke down, and my girls, you know, they just hugged me and, you know, Dad, it's going to be okay. And that really, really helped me. And I thank my wife literally every day that she sent the girls with me, because I wouldn't have been able to, I couldn't have done it without them, without their support. So I'm saying the family support was so important that, you know, that's what helped me through.
Mm-hmm. And you're very lucky that you have your family support, and it's very much like looking forward in the future, what is going to make us help to actually carry on a day-to-day life and planning the future. But you've written a book.
Yes. I wrote a book. It's called Miracles and Fate on 78.
What made you write a book? What made you?
Oh, it's a great question. It's a good story. I became a speaker, and I became a speaker because a couple of weeks after 9/11, a friend of mine approached me and said to me that her son's school was having their annual dinner. And the program was going to be 9/11, and they had two other people, and they wanted me to round out the panel to do Q&A with the audience. So she asked me if I would agree, and I said, sure, Q&A, I don't have a problem with that. And ultimately, it turned out that I found out 2 days before that it wasn't just Q&A, that I was going to have to speak for like 15 minutes, which... the woman says to me, is that going to be okay? And I go, like, I guess so. I mean, you know. So I did. I spoke for about, you know, each of us spoke for about 15 minutes or so. I told a little bit of my story. And I don't remember much, But the next day, the dean of the school called me up and asked me if I would speak to the student body. And, you know, he said it was great, whatever, and I did. And then one of the parents heard me speak, and they work for a nonprofit organization. And so she called me and said, we're having our annual tea. Would you come speak? And that's how it morphed. Now, so I started to do speaking all by word of mouth. And then invariably, I'd have people come up to me and say to me, that was great. That was a terrific talk. Can I buy your book? And I'd say, well, you could if I wrote one, but I didn't write one, so sorry. And they said, no, you need to write one. Well, it took me about 9 years to make the decision to actually write the book. Now, as I said to you, I'm a speaker, not a writer. So I said, I don't know where to start about writing a book. So somebody, a friend of mine said to me, why don't you get a ghostwriter? And I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. So I went online, I found ghostwriters, and the first guy I talked to said, hey, it's a great story, I'd love to do it, $60,000 for me to do it. And I'm like, I don't think so. Ultimately, after going through a whole bunch of ghostwriters, et cetera, I realized that if this book was going to get written, I'd have to do it myself. Mm-hmm. And I spent the next 9 months writing the book. Every literary agent that I sent it to said it was terrible. My friend who had been supporting me the whole time, who had been very supportive the whole time, said to me, just self-publish the book, which I did. And it was a little scary when the tractor trailer pulled up to my garage with 2,700 books. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at this and I'm going like, you know, two pallets of books. I'm going like, what have I just done? But believe it or not, not only did I go through that printing, I did a second printing, and I've sold to date about 4,000 books.
Wow.
A lot of them from back of the room when I speak. I sell books after I speak. A lot of them from word of mouth. It's available on Amazon. It's available from my website. So, you know, that's why I wrote it.
Mm-hmm. And did you find it helped also to put the thoughts in writing, to actually put the details in the story, and did they help you in any ways?
I will tell you that, yes, it did, but that was at the tail end, because what was really, really therapeutic for me was that, and I was very lucky that it happened, was the fact that my friend asked me to come and speak. Because as I spoke more and more, the reality of what happened sunk in. And I realized as time went on, the miracles that happened to me throughout the course of the day, obviously we didn't have time to talk about it, but it is in my book. And if anybody's interested in having a speaker and find out about what it is, you know, just, you know, you can reach out to me.
And read the details in the book. Yeah.
I felt that every time I spoke, it sunk in more and more, the miracles, and, you know, that somebody else was looking after me that day.
I mean, you were late. On that day, you were actually late. You actually turned up.
I was late because my son, I didn't do his book order. But I'll tell you something else, though. The book order was actually due on Monday. But my son left his pamphlet in school on Friday, so I couldn't do it with him. If he would have brought that pamphlet home on Friday, mm-hmm. I would have done it with him on Sunday. And I would have been sitting at my desk at 8 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday, and you'd be interviewing somebody else because I'd be dead.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a bunch
that
of
was a miracle.
There were a bunch of coincidences that happened throughout the course of the day. And so that was very therapeutic for me. It was difficult in the beginning, I'm not going to lie. Mm-hmm. All right. It was hard. There were times where I'd get up on stage, I'd look out at the crowd, and I'd break down. Even before I started to speak, I'd break down. Yeah. You know, it would take me like a couple of minutes to get back to myself. So even today, every so often, I get hit like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's understandable. It's something that it was so unexpected and so big. And even when it was happening, you didn't even know what was going on the outside. No one even knew what was happening at the time. So, yeah.
Correct. It was also, you know, it was also the fact that not only that I survived, but that I lost 658 friends and coworkers.
Yeah.
That was really, really hard to grasp. That was very difficult for me to get my arms around it. It was just, I couldn't, you know, it took a long time. And when we went back to work, I went back to work on Thursday, by the way. Okay. Oh. 9/11 happened on Tuesday. I went back to work on Thursday. I called my boss on Wednesday to find out. Well, first of all, back then it wasn't, we didn't have instant messaging. We didn't have any of this stuff. It was emails, and we were trying to figure out who was alive and who wasn't. And, that was difficult. But I called my boss on Wednesday night. I knew he was alive. And I said, John, where are we working out of? He says, well, we're working out of a disaster recovery site, but it's small. There's no room. Stay home. I said, no, you don't understand, John. I can't stay home. I need to go back to work. Mm-hmm. All right? I needed something to get my mind off of this.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And I went back to work. And it was also, for the memories of all my friends and coworkers, we needed to rebuild the company. And I went back to work Thursday, and up until 3.5 years ago when I finally left, okay, I was there all the time.
Yeah, it's when something like this happened, there is a way of being busy so that you don't think of what's happened in that sense. It's just you keep busy. And after experiences, how did you restore your sleep? How did you manage to gradually go back to sort of
time. Time. It was just it was a matter of time. Yeah, you know what they say: time heals all wounds. Mm-hmm. Not 100%.
I was gonna say no, it doesn't. Yeah, I don't think. But yeah, personally, yeah, time sort of make you see things in different perspective. But obviously, we can't change what happened. I know that even just people seeing the news. I noticed when I was seeing my clients having fear of flying, that increased terribly afterwards. I mean, people who were not even near or didn't even experience what you've experienced had fear of flying just by seeing the images on the news. So I can't even imagine being in what you've experienced, being in there. I mean, the first time you took a plane, you flew somewhere. Did you... Did that have any impact or not?
So I will tell you that I didn't really have a fear of flying, and I started to fly a lot more because I was starting to speak a lot more. So yeah. I was going all over the country. I was going international. Security obviously was much better. I always looked around, see who's getting on the plane, things like that, but. The actual, flying itself was, to me, not a big deal. Again, it was like, I just felt like, if it's my time, it's going to happen. If I already survived it, there's a reason why I survived it. I think I'm going to be okay.
Then you're not going to want to live in fear. Yeah.
My biggest fear was not that it was, if it was my time, but if it was the pilot's time.
Yeah, that would be, I once went on I was flying and somebody was really scared of flying and she's just like, I'm not going to calm down until I see the pilot. And I was like, well, I prefer to see the pilot, knowing the pilot is doing his job than coming out to see someone who's actually just having a panic. Everybody needs to do their own job. So, I had the pleasure to listen to one of your talk. And, I remember that, you mentioned something about, looking out for fire exit when you go and do a talk. Mm. This is something that you never did before.
Correct. There are a couple of things. Like when I go into a building, I always look for the exit signs because I never know when it might save my life because it did that day. And, it was like, I had to skip over that part of the story. But, when we were looking for a way out and then one of the other people that were there said, we can get out, stairwell on the left. So I was looking around for the stairwell and I looked up and I saw the exit sign and I followed the exit sign and sure enough, it led us to the stairwell. So I always tell people, I always look for those signs when I go into buildings because I never know, when it might save my life because it certainly did that day. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things that...
when you fly and they do the safety in the talk, a lot of people don't even listen to it. It's like, you know, when you fly, they said, is it the jacket is underneath your seat? And but a lot of people don't even think about it because you say, okay, fine, it's just not going to. But those are important things because, yes, like you said, like, so it makes you more aware of things. You're more high alert and you realize things are important. So.
Correct. I'll tell you, you know, and I don't know, I'm sure they do this in the UK, but like in the US, when you are working in one of the, you know, one of the tall buildings, whatever, they have these fire alarms, they have a fire drill.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. They'd have a fire drill. Mm-hmm. So they would ring the fire alarms. All right. Everybody would have to gather one of the public spaces. And then the fire warden from the building would come up and he would start, you know, telling you, you know, in case of an emergency, this is just a drill, but in case of emergency, there's stairwell A, stairwell B, stairwell C, you know, whatever. And, after 9/11, okay, I took these things very, I never took them seriously before. You know, I was, who cares? But after 9/11, I took them very, very seriously. And it really, really bothered me when we had people who just, like they said, all right, you leave your desks now and come to the gathering area. And guys would just sit there. They'd be on the phone. They'd be talking. They'd be laughing. They wouldn't. I said, you guys don't understand. This is really important. Get off the damn phone and get to the gathering station now. All right, because I was like a manager on my floor. And it was really, really important. People, I says, you need to listen to this because you don't know when this might happen again. When we first, I'll never forget, when we first moved into our new offices after 9/11, I asked the guards where the exits were. I actually walked down the stairs from my office. I walked to where the exit was, walked down the stairs, saw where it led out of the building. And as I was doing it, our CEO was doing the exact same thing. I mean, I wanted to be prepared. You know, yeah. I needed to be prepared. You know, so these are the things that I did. So I'm going to tell people out there, you know, if you do have fire drills, really, really, you need to take them seriously.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's what they do in school. I know, you know, in school they do this. And I used to work in school and people didn't take it. They didn't. Yeah, they just did the thing. Always just like a free few minutes that they don't have to be. They don't need to be in the classroom. But it is serious, and that is why it is a drill. Because in case you really need to do it for real, every minute, every second counts. And that's
correct. Correct. And they've expanded it, by the way. I know here in the States they've expanded it to not only like a fire drill if there's a fire, but if there's an active shooter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
on the premises, you know, what to do, where to go, how to go. You know, these are all things that it's unfortunate that we live in a society we have to worry about these things, but it's good that they've taken it seriously enough that they're mandating this in all the buildings. Look, you have to do this. We had to have a fire drill, I think, 3 or 4 times a year. It was mandatory, you know, and I'm thankful that it is.
I remember when I used to live in LA for a bit, and we had the earthquake drill. You know, we had to know what to do in case there was an earthquake. It's one of all those things you need to know, because unfortunately, if you ever gone through something, you need to know exactly. You need to act quickly. You don't have the time to start thinking. Okay, where is the fire exit and which way I can get out or what I need to do. So yeah. So thank you very much for reminding listeners this. Also, how did you then? You changed your career. You didn't stay in the company. You started.
No, not true.
You still in the company.
I stayed on in the company after 9/11. I left them in 2017.
Okay. What made you leave? Like, just to change?
I'm sorry?
What made you change?
Yeah, it was like, I've been there over 23 years.
Mm, wow.
So it was like, you know, it's time. It's just time. Mm-hmm. I wanted to focus on my speaking. I wanted to focus on trying to help people. I was still speaking throughout the time that I was working there, but obviously not on a full-time basis like I do now. But I felt it was important. I felt I had a message of hope, a message of, you know, there is a higher being, all right, who is looking out for us. And you know, we, what I really learned from this was, because people used to say to me, you know, why do you think you were saved? Why do you think you, it's great that you were saved, others perished, but why do you think you were saved? And I would tell them, very simple, I think I figured it out. I think my job, I think our job, all right, is to make this world a better place when we leave it than when we got here. Mm-hmm. And that's what I am trying to instill in people. Okay. We need to make the world a better place. We need to make some changes. And I tell people, change has to start with you first. Okay. You can't change the world unless you yourself change first. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? That means becoming a better person, a nicer person, a more caring person. All right. Mm-hmm. Not always being egocentric. All right. Mm-hmm. Look out for the other person. What does the other person need? And you know what? When you start helping somebody else, all right, you'll see the change that happens within you. And that's the way you change the world, all right? But it all starts with you, that inner change that you need to make.
Yeah, it's right? True. I mean, if you, they always say that if you're not in a good place and if you help somebody else, if you give some of your time and you actually help somebody else, you're genuinely, it also helps you because you're giving and that puts you in a better place already. But you're right, it's, you have to make the decision that you need to make some changes in order to achieve and in order to be in a better place, and then this, and then help and make some changes. And so then you decided to become full-time speaker, or you decided to open, so
I decided to become a full-time speaker, which also meant that I had more time to spend with my family, mm-hmm. Which was great. I used to, you know, I always missed, you know, the school plays or the class trips, you know, when my kids would want me to come and go, whatever. And I, you know, it was like, I can't, I have to work. That was,
did that change? Did this
100% change? Mm-hmm. That 100% changed, you know, once, especially when I left, you know, it was like, you know, I'm there wherever my kids need me, wherever my grandkids need me. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm there because that's what's important in life.
That's my family, part of life. That's the memories, and you can't lose all those memories. You have to create memories. And this is what's important. This is one of those things that I also decided to think when my late daughter passed away afterwards, I decided I'm no longer going to work long hours, and I'll be there for every single school show. I'll be there to take them to school, to collect them. Things changed. That was much more important for me to be there and to enjoy that time, even driving to take them to school. When I used to hear mum complaining, oh, you know, the rota and the school drive. And so I was like, I love it. This is a privilege for me. It's how you perceive things and how you see things. And it's a privilege to be able to take your children to school. So yeah, it's definitely a big change.
I think one of the positive byproducts of this whole COVID situation, mm-hmm. is the fact that people are at home and they are spending more time, mm-hmm. all right, and they're mm-hmm. now real parents, all right, and you know it's a blessing in disguise. It really, really is.
You spend more time, and I mean, you know, we all got stuck, everyone at home, and online schooling, and it's all about adjusting. It's all about adjusting and realizing what's important and realizing what you have, and the fact just of traveling somewhere, no one thought that it would be stopped, and no one thought that you could, that just even like seeing, like I would like to go to France to see my parents. We haven't seen them for a while. It's not possible at the moment because quarantine and everything, but all those things makes you realize how grateful we have this freedom of deciding if you wanted to go on holiday, deciding where you want to go. And it's all about adapting and realizing what's important.
100%, you know, and that's why I developed my program of believe it or not, is called what? It's called Decide, Change, Succeed. Mm-hmm. That's what it's called, all right? Because that's what it is. And life is a decision.
Yes.
Okay? What happens to you, you can't change. The only thing you can change is your reaction to it. How mm-hmm. do you react to the things that happen to you? All right? And that, you know, that makes it either a very positive experience or a very negative experience. All right. It's up to you. How do you view it? How do you feel? I'm going to tell you again, I've changed a lot. And, you know, people used to ask me, how come, but how did it stick? You know, very often we see people go through something traumatic, whether good or bad. Mm-hmm. All right. And then, you know, they make a decision. They go, you know, they were saved from a fire, and they go like, oh my God, you know, I what a miracle. I'm going to change. And then 3 days later, they're back to where they were. Mm-hmm. Right. I think with me, it was the fact that it took a long time. It wasn't something that happened overnight. I didn't change overnight. It was a process. And because it was a process, that's why it stuck. And I decided that whatever happens to me, I know is got to be for the best, regardless of what it is. And sometimes I don't understand it. You know, when my father passed away, I didn't understand it. He was, you know, a pillar in my life, but I didn't understand it. But I realized that whatever it is, it's for the best. All right. That's what, and if you take that attitude that whatever happens, it is for the best. All right. Life is going to get a lot easier.
Of course,
right?
You can't change the fact things happen, but you can change. I always say it's not even how you react, it's how you respond to the actual event that happened. And you can decide. And if you decide that it was meant to be, and I can take the good out of it and transform it, then you can move forward. And it's very much to try not to be stuck in that event and stuck into what happened, and it is a process, because you do need the guidance, and that's why you're doing your program. It doesn't happen just like this. We all need guidance. We all need to know what process we can use in order to actually get to where we want to get. And you do need help, because it's hard to see it yourself. It's impossible to see yourself. You really need the support to actually know where you want to go, because when we're in it, we don't really see it.
I got a lot of inspiration. I read your book, Live Life Leora.
Oh yeah, How to Move Forward When the Unthinkable Happen. Yes, Love, yes. Light, and so Leora.
Right. I read that book, and the thing that touched me the most was the attitude that you took in the book, where you said, well, you know what? At least God gave me this gift for 20 years.
Yeah.
At least I had this gift for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Right. So you took an unbearable situation. I don't know if I could have done what you did. But you took an unbearable situation and you said to yourself, this was a gift from God. He wanted to take the gift back. Who am I to complain? I had it for 20 years and it was wonderful. So, you know, people need to realize that as well. I mean, look, losing a child obviously is one of the worst things in the world.
You know, I'm glad I didn't know that it would have going to happen, because otherwise every memory would have been ruined, because I would have been on high alert. But, for me, that was, it was the most beautiful gift that I've been given for 20 years. And the relationship that I had with my daughter was beautiful. And I always see it as, you know, when you walk into a garden and you're attracted to the most beautiful flowers, and you feel like you want to pick a flower. And this is what happened. I just feel that she needed, you know, Creator needed her more than we needed her in a physical world, and therefore I have to be grateful. And that's what made me also writing the book and explaining this. But this is how I see it: is moving forward. Is how we can easily get stuck and not move. And you also made that decision, and this is why I like your program saying decide, because once you make a decision that you're going to make some changes and move forward and not be stuck in that event that happened, and let that event have this big impact on you by a negative way, then things will happen and you will make some changes. And you did. And now you're helping other people. So that's great. And I hope that our listeners will really take this. What would you say to... Do you have a sentence or something that our listeners can keep in mind to help them until maybe they go and and see your program. But what would you say to people if they are, especially now with COVID, in total fear or not trusting?
I think my advice to people, you know, like right off the bat, I'll always tell people, as I said before, we need to change. Now, I don't want people changing overnight. All right. It's like if you're going to go on a diet, right? So what happens? You say, I'm going to lose 50 pounds, right? And then 3 days later, you know, it's the ice cream following the pizza and it's all over, right? Why is that? Do you know why that is? Because it's, again, it's too much to put your arms around. 50 pounds. It's a lot. You know, you start and, you know, I lost a half a pound, whatever. You know what I'm saying? It's like too much. But if you go out and you say, okay, I need to get on a diet. You know what? I'm going to lose 2 pounds this week. Right? And that's easy. That's doable. Mm-hmm. Right? And then the following you go, you know what? I'm going to lose 2 pounds this week. That's doable. By the end of the year, you've lost 100 pounds. Why? Because you took bite-sized pieces.
Yes, most definitely.
So when I tell people you need to change, I don't want you to change overnight. What I want you to do is I want you to take one thing, just one thing that you're not doing today that could make your life better. Whether it's, you know, maybe it's giving more charity, maybe it's helping at a soup kitchen, maybe it's just doing something for a neighbor, just doing a nice thing for a neighbor, just one thing. Okay. And when you do that, you're going to, you'll feel it. It's going to have an effect on you. And from that one change, that will lead to more changes. But you can't say, I'm going to completely change, you know, my life.
No, because right? It won't last.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It's
so
the way
that's my advice. That's my advice to people. All right. And that's why I talk about my program. I say, I don't want you to change 50 things. Okay. It's just impossible. All right. Just one. Right. And you know what, whatever you decide to do, whatever the change is, I tell people, write it down. Okay. Mm-hmm. Put it on a post-it note, stick it on your refrigerator so that every day you're looking at what you decided to do. It stares you in the face. Okay. Every day. That's, you know, it only takes 30 days to form a habit.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. Mm-hmm. 30 days to form a habit. So you know what? Put it on the refrigerator. You do that for 30 days. It's a habit. Now, guess what? Now you're ready for the next change.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
All right? And ultimately. Mm-hmm.
No. So, just reminding our listeners, where can they find your program if they want to look more? What's your website? Do you have a website?
I have a website. Mm-hmm. It's called www.arischonbrunn.com.
Okay.
That is ArischonBrunn, ArischonBrunn.com. You can find the program there. You can, there is a form to fill out. If you want to speak to me, if you want to have a conversation, you can go to www.callwithari.com. You can schedule a time on my calendar.
Okay.
And we can talk about, you know, you know, whatever you want to talk about for 30 minutes, mm-hmm. Okay, you've got me.
Good.
And right? Just book it.
And we can find your book on Amazon, yes?
Book you can find on Amazon. For whatever reason, there are resellers of my book. Don't pay, important, do not pay $50 for my book, okay? You can get it. Make sure that that when you go on Amazon that you're on my Amazon link. All right, it's $17.99. Mm-hmm. Okay, do not pay $50 for the book, because there are people who have copies of it that are selling it for $50.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Thank you very
much. Also, by the way, it's also available on Kindle as an ebook.
So, yeah,
right?
Excellent.
Is a lot easier if you're overseas.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So, thank you so much for your time, and thank you very much for talking to our listeners. And I just wish you luck in your new program and new coaching.
So, thank you so much, Lauren. Thank you so much for having me on. And again, you are my strength. All right. I hope keep doing what you're doing, because it's really, really important.
And thank you very much. Thank you.